Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, December 27, 2023, on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, and my co-host Ron Meniza is doing setup things, and he's fixing the pellet stove and all kinds of cool stuff. I'm coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You can also check out my Facebook page and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. All right, so update on health stuff. I had a bit of a setback, and one thing I want to let you know is that if you have autonomic nervous system stuff, don't overdo caffeine and sugar. Also, if you have a health condition, don't overdo caffeine and sugar. Also, if you're alive, don't overdo caffeine and sugar. So if you're me, don't overdo caffeine and sugar, because my dysautonomia, one of my symptoms is I get tremors. And when I get the tremors, it usually means, I mean, will be set off by stress, but more it's set off by inflammation, because I can be stressed and not get tremors. I think inflammation is what sets it off. So overdoing sugar will give me inflammation. And then when you consume caffeine, you're increasing cortisol, you're increasing your catecholamines, your fight or flight hormones, your epinephrine, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Dopamine feels good when it's elevated because it gives you a good mood rush. But if you have too much of those hormones and you happen to be a hyperadrenergic person in the first place, it doesn't go well. So I wound up having a bit of caffeine, or maybe too much caffeine for me, every day for a long time, combined with nipping at the sugar. So why would I do this if I'm a naturopathic physician and I'm, you know, concerned about my health? And first of all, not only am I a naturopathic physician, I'm a person. So people do stuff. And it doesn't matter what your profession is, you may have your things that you like. And I like to eat sweets. So I have to really watch how much sweets I eat. And I have to, I like to enjoy them sometimes. And I think it's possible to enjoy sweets in moderation. But I was doing too much for me in the context of a lot of stress, just doing a lot of work and a lot of exercise and a lot of too much stuff and preparing to go away to Florida. And I didn't wind up going to Florida because one of my symptoms was GI upset, and my mom was concerned I had something that she didn't want me to bring to her. Otherwise, I would have probably gone. I wound up taking it really, really easy. I'd had the week off because I was supposed to go to Florida, and I did a lot of resting, a lot of yin yoga. I didn't do much in the way of cardio exercise, and I increased detox. I increased detoxifying herbs and some of the things I like to take when I think I'm having a Lyme flare. And one of the things that I read, I was reading Daniel Cameron. Daniel Cameron is a Lyme literate doctor. And one of the things I was reading for him, if you have been injured by the vaccine, by if you have purportedly vaccine injury from the COVID-19 vaccines and you are having symptoms, one of the things to do is check yourself for chronic Lyme. And if that's going on, then you treat for chronic Lyme and it will help. And that has been my experience. So when I'm treating for chronic Lyme, I'm increasing herbs like Japanese knotweed. I already have Chinese skullcap in my collagen that I'm taking. I am taking some detoxifying herbs like berberine and pinella, which detoxify the liver, lymphatics, and kidneys, as well as the nervous system. I take motherwort anyway because I have a lot of it. And motherwort is a great herb to calm your heart. It's a great nerving herb, so it calms your entire nervous system. And Lyme disease can affect the heart, and so can dysautonomia. So motherwort is a great herb to keep you calm. It's also great if you're a mother and you have a lot of things going on. And it's a friend to mothers. And I do not have biological children, but you are all my children. And in my naturopathic practice, it is as though my patients are my children. So I have a motherly aspect to me. Even my physician described me as matronly. What are you going to do? So, I mean, I guess at 60, I could be matronly, huh? So, well, that's fine. So anyway, today I'm feeling pretty good. My energy is good. One of the symptoms you get is like terrible fatigue, and I had some days of that where you sleep and you're still tired. Today, I don't feel like that. Today, I feel good. It's nice and sunny out. I'm going to have a couple of days of patient care, and then it will be Christmas, because I'm recording this before Christmas, but you will, you could be listening to this at any time during the week. So I'm doing okay at the moment. I'm going to cut way back on the caffeine and way back on the sugar. I recommend the same for you. The big thing is that sugar can cause inflammation. It increases your insulin, and insulin pushes all kinds of inflammatory compounds. So I want to give a shout out. My old roommate from Portland, Oregon was listening, Karen. So hi, Karen, out there in Oregon or wherever you are listening from. So big shout out. Anyway, so I wanted to talk a little bit more about my big birthday. I have entered my 7th decade. And yes, I am 60 years old, but so you may think, isn't that the 6th decade? No, because your first decade starts when you're born, when you're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Your second decade starts when you turn 10. So no, I am in my 7th decade. I have just begun my 7th decade. Oh, another big shout out to Brian. Hi, Brian. He's listening too. He asked me to come on down because he is a big fan of The Price is Right. So big shout out to Brian. Miss him. We'll get down to Westerly and visit and hang out on WBLQ at some point soon. All right. So anyway, big birthday. Am I feeling like, oh no, I'm 60. This is a big number. I'm not worried about that. I don't care how old I am as long as I feel good. What I'm more concerned about is that my health has been up and down. And if I feel fabulous and I'm in my 60s, 70s, whatever, I'm fine. You know. So I think the sleuthing to be done is how to keep myself healthy at this age. Regardless of the age, I mean, there's going to be some challenges because I've been on the planet for 60 years. But the 60 is not as much of the issue as day-to-day health issues. And so that means eating healthfully. That means getting lots of rest. I need more rest than I used to. I can't get away with like having a poor night's sleep as easily as I could. I can't get away with getting up too early in the morning or going to sleep too late at night. So I have to get lots of sleep. We're talking at least 8 hours. And if I get less than that, I really don't feel well. And I'm more likely to have symptoms. So taking breaks during the day, doing my yoga is essential, especially yin and restorative yoga. Those are my favorite kind of yoga is yin, where I'm holding the poses for a long time and I'm doing a lot of deep breathing. I think that doing a regular practice of that keeps my vagus nerve active and makes it so that I'm overall calmer, and it makes it so that I'm not as likely to have adrenal dumps. And of course, avoiding caffeine, you're less likely to have adrenal dumps because caffeine pushes your adrenals. It makes it so your catecholamines. So if you're curious about caffeine, we'll do a little bit of a review. The deal with caffeine is caffeine makes you feel good. Unless you are so sensitive to it, then no amount makes you feel good. But caffeine does make me feel good. I enjoy a little bit, and I enjoy the flavors of the things that have caffeine in it, especially a really good cup of coffee. I like a little bit of chocolate, and I love a good matcha latte, and I love a good chai, and I love a good cup of high-quality black tea with honey in it. So I love all those things. It's not like I'm a big addict, because having one cup a day is sometimes too much for me. So I'm able to regulate that. But what I get when I get into trouble is when I have a little bit of a latte and I'm sipping off it all day. And then I get into a situation where there's too much. So I haven't tested myself, and I may want to do this. There is a way to do genetic testing to find out. So have you heard on TV that if you're taking sip blah, blah, blah inhibitors or drugs that are active in the sip blah, blah, blah system, that you have to be careful with this drug that we're advertising to you? So SIP doesn't stand for SIP. It stands for CYP. It's cytochrome P450. So there are many cytochrome P450 enzymes, and the one that manages caffeine is CYP or SIP1A2. And you can be a slow, medium, or fast metabolizer depending on your genetics. I mean, I could test myself, but I put money on I'm a slow metabolizer just because I know that a little goes a long way. Ron makes his wonderful coffee. I can have a quarter cup or less, like an eighth of a cup, and then I start chattering endlessly. And he's like, "Did you have caffeine?" And the amount of caffeine I had was an iota of what he had. I mean, he can drink whole carafes and be a little bit energized, and he can go to sleep at night and have no problem. If I drink lots of caffeine, I'm more likely to have poorer sleep. And that's the thing, when I get off caffeine, my sleep is deeper and better, and I'm more likely to sleep through the night. So we've decided that I should really limit my caffeine to very small amounts, not daily, and better off on a day when I've gotten a decent amount of cardio exercise. So not just like a half hour gentle walk. We're talking, I went on at least a 20 odd mile bike ride, or I went for a run or something. So I'm going to have to limit it to that. Or because when I get into having it too much, my vagus nerve can't handle it. My vagus nerve is delicate, and it's been delicate, unfortunately, since late 2021. So, and I just, that's just the way it is right now, and I have to realize that. So anyway, caffeine increases catecholamines because it is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, and phosphodiesterase is an enzyme that breaks down catecholamines, and your catecholamines would be your dopamine. Dopamine is important for movement, it's important for mood, it's important for pleasure. So you have more dopamine around. That's why consuming caffeine is a pleasure. It increases norepinephrine and epinephrine, which increases your heart rate and your breathing rate and your blood pressure so that you can run away from the bear. To that extent, it will also increase cortisol. And it also, so those are among the ways it works. So you have a more of a less breakdown of those catecholamine neurotransmitters. So you feel more energized. That's part of the mechanism by which you feel more energized. And then the other thing that it does is it blocks adenosine receptors, and adenosine bonds, it bonds lightly. There's less adenosine. You make your adenosine, it has the same kind of relationship to melatonin. So your melatonin is going to be highest in the evening, and so is your adenosine. So your adenosine is lowest in the morning, so you have a lot of energy, and then it's going to be highest in the evening. It starts to creep up, and then it bonds to receptors in your brain, and it gives you a feeling of being tired. And if you have a normal amount, you're going to feel pleasantly tired in the evening until it's time for you to go to sleep. And then you go to sleep. And the same thing with your melatonin. Your melatonin increases during the day. And you want to go to sleep. I've said this before. You want to go to sleep when your melatonin is peaking and you're going to have the best night's sleep. If you do that, that's where that saying comes in. Any hour before midnight counts as two, because when you go to sleep during your melatonin peak, you're going to get a better night's sleep than if you go to sleep, if you wait till afterwards. And also, if your melatonin has not peaked, so say your melatonin peaks at 10 o'clock and you try to go to sleep at 8, you might not be able to fall asleep. My mom insists now, I cannot go to sleep before 10 o'clock or I'll toss and turn. So her melatonin is probably starting to peak at around 10 o'clock, and that's a great time to go to sleep. Although some people who are early birds, their melatonin is going to peak at like 8 or 9 o'clock and they're going to go to bed earlier, and then it's going to drop and bottom out at like 5 or 6 o'clock and they're going to get up early in the morning. That's not me. I'm ready to get up somewhere between 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm not happy if I get up much earlier than that. And then there are people who are night owls. And to me, it's not clear if the night owls are... they've pushed themselves to a point where they've gotten their melatonin to peak at, 11 o'clock in the morning, and they've pushed it that way, or that's just how they naturally are. That's just how their circadian cycle works. But in any case, you're going to want to go to sleep when your melatonin is highest, and you're not going to function very well when your melatonin is highest. So if you're forced to function in the middle of the day when you have high melatonin, you're not going to be able to do that. So people like that tend to find jobs where they are able to work when they're at their most alert. And can you tweak your melatonin? Yes, you can tweak it by taking it. And you can take melatonin, like people who work night shifts, who are not naturally night owls, they can alter their circadian cycle by taking melatonin. It's not a wonderful thing to do, and people with who work night shifts do have health problems. So anyway, so caffeine, as I said, what it does is it does two things. It increases your catecholamines, and then it also blocks adenosine. So whenever you take it, it's blocking your adenosine. So your adenosine is prevented from making you feel sleepy. Now, so what happens anytime you block a neurotransmitter or use an agent like a pharmaceutical to block a neurotransmitter, your body goes, whoa, hey, I have less of this neurotransmitter and I'm supposed to have it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to increase the receptors. So if there's more receptors and you have a reduced amount of that neurotransmitter, you're going to, whatever's around is going to be more likely to be able to bond because there are more receptors. Now, what happens if you take away the agent that was making you these receptors? So it's two things. If you so with adenosine, you're blocking the adenosine, so you're going to make more adenosine receptors so that the adenosine can bond. And conversely, so say you take an SSRI, a serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor, and that's going to make it so that there's more serotonin around for you. So in that postsynaptic site, what happens? You don't increase receptors, you decrease them. So in either case, when you stop taking the agent, when you stop the caffeine, now you have all these extra adenosine receptors. So whatever adenosine's around is going to bond. So you stop your caffeine, you're going to feel much, much more sleepy. That's exactly what happened to me. I was no good to the world for a number of days until it sorted itself out. And today I feel pretty good. So hopefully my adenosine receptor population has gone down. And that's why I might be able to get away with having caffeine a couple of times a week. So I'm not in a position where I've increased my adenosine receptor so much that when I'm off it, I feel lousy. So, you know, what will happen to me is I'll have the caffeine in the morning. I'll feel pretty good through the day. But when the caffeine wears off, I have a crash. And then it goes up and down and up and down. And it's really unpleasant. So if I have it a couple times a week, then I'm going to be in a situation where I'm not pushing it so much that I'm having this increased adenosine receptor population. The other thing is if I do it on days when my metabolism is faster because I've gotten a lot of cardio exercise, then I'm going to process the caffeine through my system faster anyway. There'll be more phosphodiesterase. There'll be a faster rate of circulation. My blood will see my liver many more times, and so it'll be seeing the phosphodiesterase more times, and it'll get broken down more quickly. So, but on days when I need to be calm and days when I'm not doing a lot of cardio activity or a lot of, physical activity, no caffeine. That's how it's going to go, unfortunately. And so, like I was talking about with an SSRI, you're going to decrease the receptor population where the serotonin is going to bond. If you stop that SSRI, then all of a sudden you don't have enough receptors. You're making less serotonin and you don't have a lot of receptors, so there's no place for it to bond. So you get low serotonin problems and people get sensations in their brain. They get digestive upset. Of course, their mood will decrease and they get these zapping sensations in their brain. The serotonin's trying to bond and has nowhere to go. So I'm not sure what's happening there, but there's a lot of symptoms that happen when you are trying to decrease your get off an SSRI. So anyway, so I think for the moment I may have made it through a bit of caffeine withdrawal, and I'm gonna have to be super careful about consuming caffeine, and of course super careful about consuming sugar. And that's one of the things that I have to do for the rest of my life, is that I have to watch that. Stress, of course, affects the whole thing, because during stress hormones, I'll make my own cortisol anyway. So that pushes my system too, and that becomes exhausting as well. So reducing stress is a good thing. And how do I reduce stress? I do less stuff. I unfortunately do less cardio. I rest more. I sleep more. I like to read books. And when I read for pleasure, I like to read paper books. I have a nice relationship with the Mansfield Public Library. I find reading on paper books more relaxing than reading on on devices because it's less of a strain on my eyes, and I just become relaxed, and it's very nice. And then the other thing I like to do is all kinds of yoga. I don't do any more than moderate yoga. So I do moderate yoga classes. I do yoga stretches. So they would be a short workout I might find on YouTube that's not too intense. So I don't do power yoga, and I don't do very athletic yoga. I do moderate yoga. I do yoga stretches. I do yin yoga, which is where you're holding the poses for a good amount of time in a good stretch. And I do restorative yoga, which is gentle stretches where you're holding the poses for a very long time. And then sometimes I do yoga nidra. And yoga nidra is completely a guided meditation. You're just lying comfortably and listening and doing a progressive relaxation as you're being guided. It's very nice. All right. So nutrition is really important. As I said, for me, that's going to be protein and produce. It's not going to be super low carb, but, you know, it's not going to, reducing sugar is going to be important, because I do eat, I try to have no more than one slice of bread a day or less. I do eat a little bit of rice. I don't eat rice most days. I do eat quinoa some days. I do eat oats, a small amount of oats most days. And then I eat, I take protein shakes. I have turkey breast. I have some dairy alternatives because I don't do too well with dairy. So the dairy alternatives have gotten so good. So I will have some of those for flavor. And I do coconut based yogurt for the probiotics and for something to put my my muesli and my fruit in and my seeds. And I eat seeds. I eat hemp seeds, chia seeds, and flax seeds. And you know, we have wonderful protein and vegetable dinners, and that's going to either be some kind of a stir fry, some kind of a soup, or some kind of a salad with a protein, and that might be chicken or turkey or fish, and that's mostly what I eat. And then if I'm having treats, I try to have small amounts of those and make them organic, and you know, like high quality chocolate that's at least 70% that's at least 70% cocoa. And I like to make fruit crumbles at home, and I'm going to be able to control the ingredients better. So small amounts of coconut sugar, maple syrup, and lots of cinnamon. And sometimes I'll use real butter because I can tolerate real butter, but sometimes I'll use some. Now, again, the cashew and coconut based butters are amazing, and they're really great for baking. So I might use that. So I'm trying to watch my health and watch my nutrition that way. That's one of the things that I'm doing. All right, so let's talk about a few things that you need to be concerned about when you're getting older. One of them is building healthy bone. So maintaining your bone density. I have people come in who are like, I've been diagnosed with osteopenia. It's not clear to me if you need to really treat yourself if you have osteopenia. Osteopenia is sort of in between the parameters for normal and absolute osteoporosis. So it's not clear if you have to treat it. If you've been told you have osteopenia, it's probably a good idea simply to make sure that you're eating a nutritious diet and that you're getting regular exercise, especially weight-bearing exercise. So as you get older, your bone density does drop. And one of the problems with measuring bone density is that older ladies, you know, people my age, are compared by bone density to a healthy woman who's in her 20s. So it doesn't really make sense. You are supposed to lose some bone density as you get older. And the whole point of talking about bone density is your bone density is a problem if you're going to get a fracture. And if you have lower bone density but you never get a fracture, what's the point of treating it? So really that's what you're looking for. You're looking for a way to maintain strong bones, and maintain your body so that you're not in a position where you're going to fall and break something. That's what you're after. That's the most important thing. So how do you maintain your nice bone density? One of the things is to eat a lot of veggies. So why would veggies increase your bone density? Vegetables, not just fruit, but vegetables have vitamin C in it. And vitamin C stimulates the production of your osteoblasts. Those are the cells that make bone. Vitamin C also can help to protect your bones from damage. Veggies on their own increase bone density. If you eat a lot of green and yellow vegetables, that has been linked to higher mineralization during childhood and the maintenance of it in adulthood. So if you're not getting your veggies in, and I have people come in all the time who are like, well, I eat fruit, but I'm not eating vegetables. Or they're eating a diet where they're eating cheese and crackers, and they're eating pasta, and they're eating sandwiches, and there's no appreciable vegetables in their diet. And I see a lot of people like that because people are just exhausted and stressed and they don't want to cook. And I say, this is a time where either you have to learn how to prep, make food in advance, or you need to think about getting a meal service, something that, a service that will make food for you so that you always have something healthy around. You're more likely to get osteoporosis as you get older because there's increased bone turnover and that you have a little more breaking down than building up. There was a 3-month study where women who ate more than 9 servings of broccoli, cabbage, or parsley, or other plants that are high in bone protecting antioxidants had a decrease in bone turnover. So if you eat a lot of vegetables, your bones won't turn over as quickly and you will keep more of your minerals. Doing strength training and weight-bearing exercise is very important for bone density. Bones are a tissue that's a move-it-or-lose-it phenomenon. You really need to maintain, you really need to tell your bones, hey, I'm going to use you, so I want you to maintain me. And so weight-bearing or even high-impact exercise helps to form new bone. And it's been studied in people, in children, it's been studied in people with type 1 diabetes, and it helps to prevent bone loss when you get older. There are studies that show that men and women who perform weight-bearing exercises, they show increases in bone density, strength, and size, and reduced markers of bone turnover. Exercise that with strength training also increases your muscle mass, which helps prevent against bone loss in women of all ages, even if you have osteoporosis, osteopenia, or even breast cancer. There was a study in men with low bone mass that found that although resistance training and weight bearing exercise increased bone density, only resistance training had this effect in the hip. So it's really important to do. So how does weight-bearing exercise increase your bone mass? Well, when you're doing weight-bearing exercise, the muscles are pulling on the bones. And when they pull on the bones, they create a little electrical current called a piezoelectric current, and that draws the minerals back into the bones. The other thing that happens is when you do weight-bearing exercise, you're going to increase your muscle mass. When you increase your muscle mass, skeletal muscle produces testosterone. You have more testosterone when you have more muscle mass, and testosterone in turn maintains the muscle mass. You have these heavier muscles holding onto the bones. So if you have the weight pulling against the bones, heavier weight pulls against bones and tells the bones to increase their density. So muscle mass does it in a number of ways. The other thing that happens is if you do weight-bearing exercise, you're going to improve your balance. And if you improve your balance, you're going to be less likely to fall. And if you fall, you're going to be less likely to break something because you have padding from the muscle mass. So the other thing that you're doing when you're doing weight-bearing exercise is not just about how much mineralization is in the bones. It's also about the tensile strength, that the bones need to be resilient. So when they whack against something, they're less likely to break. Something that's springy is going to be less likely to break. Something that's more brittle is going to be more likely to break. So if you have more tensile strength in your bones, that you have more resilience, you're less likely to break something. And when you do weight-bearing exercise, you increase the tensile strength of your bones. Okay, You need to eat protein. Why you need to eat protein? Because protein is part of your bones. Protein is also part of your muscle mass. And I see people who they just don't get enough protein. Oh, I don't like meat. I want to be a vegetarian. I'm not insulting vegetarians. If you are a vegetarian, you just have to be careful to make sure that you're getting enough protein. Whatever way that you are deciding to eat, whether you're a vegan, an ovo-lacto-vegetarian, or a person who eats meat, you have to make sure that you're getting enough protein every day. And I say the minimum amount of protein that anybody should be getting is probably around 70 grams a day, and it's probably more if you're doing any kind of physical activity. And if you're not a person who likes to eat animal protein, then you have to look at, are you willing to eat more beans? Are you willing to eat more nuts and seeds? Are you willing to take protein powders that agree with you? Getting enough protein. You need the protein to build the bone mass, and you need the protein to build your muscle mass. About 50% of your bone is made of protein, so it's got to come from somewhere. Protein is an essential nutrient, and the amino acids that are in protein, there are 9 essential amino acids. In order to get those essential amino acids, you have to eat protein. So now, there are concerns about high-protein diets leaching calcium from bones, but people who consume up to 100 grams of protein a day that's balanced with plenty of plant foods, then they're going to get the calcium from the plant food. So if you just eat protein, you might be more likely to lose bone mineral mass. But if you eat a combination of protein and veggies, you're going to get your calcium and other minerals that you need for bone density, and you're not going to be as likely to lose bone mineral mass. You're not going to leach calcium from your bones. Women in particular have better bone mass density when they consume higher amounts of protein. So it's a good idea to eat protein. There was a large observational study of over 144,000 postmenopausal women, that's me, when they ate higher protein, they had a lower risk, they studied forearm fractures, and they had a lower risk of forearm fractures and higher bone density in the hip, spine, and in their body in general. Diets with a greater percentage of calories from protein can help preserve bone mass during weight loss. So if you're trying to lose weight, you're going to be more likely to lose your bone mass if you're not eating enough protein. So there's a one-year study, women who had 86 grams of protein a day and a calorie-restricted diet lost less bone mass from the arms, hips, spine, and leg areas than women who ate only 60 grams of protein. That's why I'm telling people, at least 70 grams of protein a day. I give handouts. I give out a handout that has all different kinds of foods, both vegetarian and animal. And it tells you the grams of protein, and I tell people mix and match, choose your favorites, just get yourself up to at least 70 grams of protein, if not more. This says here 86 grams of protein, and that's 86, that's if you're on a calorie-restricted diet, but probably eating that much is a good idea. Throughout the day, you want to eat foods that are high in calcium, not necessarily taking a calcium pill, but eat foods with high calcium throughout the day. And there's an RDI of 1,000 milligrams, but if you're a teen, you need more, and older women need 1,200. And you don't have to take it all in pills. You can get it in various forms of calcium throughout your body. That's why I always tell people, if you're going to take a calcium supplement, don't take any more than 500 to 600 milligrams a day. You're going to get, it's better to get other calcium and phytonutrients from your food. So if you have a meal that has more than 500 milligrams of calcium, your body is going to absorb less of it than if you eat a lower amount. So that's why you want to spread your calcium through the day. So maybe nuts and seeds in your cereal in the morning, if you're having oatmeal or some kind of a healthy cereal. If you can tolerate dairy, you can have some dairy throughout the day. If you don't tolerate dairy, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds and vegetables throughout the day. And if you're consuming bone broth, if you're eating, if you eat bone broth or you're having bone broth protein, you're going to get some minerals from that bone broth. So I take bone broth protein, and we don't have it every day, but we have, when we have soups, the soups are based with bone broth. And so you're going to get calcium that way. There was a 10-year study of almost 1,600 people. They found that with high calcium intake from foods, It decreases the risk of heart disease overall. Those who took calcium supplements had a greater 22% greater risk of heart disease. So be careful with calcium supplements. You don't want to take a lot. If you're taking calcium supplements, you want to also take magnesium. That's going to lower your risk of cardiovascular disease. And it's better to get your calcium from food. I don't actually take calcium in pills. I take magnesium, I take vitamin K2, and I take vitamin D, but I don't take calcium in pills. I rely on my food to get my calcium. And I do eat a fair bit of nuts and seeds and bone broth and a lot of vegetables. So that's how I'm doing it. Get your vitamin D and K. So get your vitamin D tested. Ask your doctor to do that. And you want your vitamin D levels to be somewhere between 35 and 45 nanograms per milliliter. That's the best information I have in terms of studies. You don't need it to be higher than 45 nanograms per milliliter. And if you get it higher than 55, you're going to start having problems. You can start seeing problems from having vitamin D, like too much calcification in your blood. And if you don't take it with vitamin K, one of the things is that vitamin K will direct calcium to go where it's supposed to go. And vitamin K also helps you to absorb your vitamin D better. So it's a really good idea to do vitamin D and vitamin K together. Most of my patients come in low. Most people are not between 35 and 45 nanograms per milliliter. So I live in Connecticut. In Connecticut, half the year, we don't see enough sunshine to help you make enough vitamin D. And so I'm having my patients take vitamin D, and usually with vitamin K. I like to give them drops because they're very economical and you can tweak the dose very easily. And I have drops that come in, they're 1,000 IU per drop, which is 25 micrograms. And so depending on where a person comes in, you know, you can tell them take one drop, two drops, three drops. And here's a big caveat. If you're taking vitamin D drops, please, you're not going to be taking a lot of drops because vitamin D drops come... Like I have a brand that comes, it's 1,000 IU. A lot of commercial brands are 1,000 IU per drop. And some brands are 2,000 IU per drop. And what I don't want you to do is just squirt it in your mouth. And I don't want you to squirt it into your drink. Okay, so if you squirt it into your drink, you don't know if that vitamin D is going to get lost in the glass. If it's going to stick to the side, you don't know if it's going to get in. I had another patient who was taking a dropper full and just squirting it in her mouth. And then I tested her and her vitamin D level was 73. And I said, I was like, what are you doing? And she told me she was squirting it in her mouth. And I told her, you can't do that. So what I like people to do, if I've said to you, I want you to take two drops a day, I want you to take a spoon and go drop, drop on the spoon. I want you to be able to see the drops on the spoon, and then I want you to lick it off. And most vitamin D doesn't taste like anything. It's either put in, I have one brand that's in olive oil and another brand that's in MCT oil. So if you're coconut sensitive, you can't do the MCT, medium chain triglycerides. But if you can, the medium chain triglycerides taste like almost like nothing. It's like if water could be oil, that's what MCT tastes like. So it barely tastes like anything. Two drops on the spoon, lick it off and lick off the spoon completely. And if you, or if you need to do olive oil, then that's great because you're going to get the vitamin D in olive oil and you're going to get some olive oil on board. So that's a good thing too. So anyway, vitamin D deficiency is so common. And, you know, most people in the United States live in regions where you don't get enough sunshine for most of the year. And if you go outside covered up, your body has to mostly be uncovered in order for you to absorb vitamin D. And you have to get good sun exposure. People go outside and they're either covered up or they're wearing sunscreen. So some people come in and they're between 35 and 45 nanograms per milliliter. And I'm like, mazel tov, that's great. You don't need a supplement. Most of my patients come in, they wind up having to take vitamin D. And vitamin D is so important for your bone density. It's important for your thyroid. It's important for your immune system. It's important for thyroid function. And it's important to protect you from, you get musculoskeletal pain when you don't have enough vitamin D on board. I've had people, you know, not, and then I have people who they, when their vitamin D is low, they have mood issues. So vitamin D is super important for all of those things. So vitamin D, so we check their vitamin D and we offer it to them. And then vitamin K2 supports your bone health by modifying osteocalcin, which is a protein that's involved in bone formation. It helps osteocalcin to bind to minerals in bones and helps prevent the loss of calcium from bones. So vitamin K2 is going to help to draw the calcium in towards the bones. And vitamin K2 also helps you to absorb vitamin D. Vitamin K2 is commonly MK4 and MK7. MK4 is in small amounts in liver, eggs, and meat, and fermented foods like cheese, sauerkraut, and natto, which is a fermented soybean product, have MK7 in it. There was a study that showed that MK7 raises K2 more than MK4, but there are other studies that show that supplementing with either form of K2 supports osteocalcin modification, increases bone density in both children and in postmenopausal women. And then there was a big study where women who were 50 to 65 years of age who took MK4, they maintained their bone density, whereas the group that had a placebo had a decrease after 12 months. So another 12-month study found no significant difference in bone loss between women whose diets had natto and who didn't take natto. All right. The next thing, if you want to have good bone density, very low calorie diets are not a good idea. So, those things where you have a couple days a week where you're doing 500 calories, maybe that's not such a good idea. That's stressful on your body, and you're probably not going to absorb the nutrients that you need to maintain your bone density. So there was a study where women who consumed 925 calories per day, I'd be starving, for 4 months, had a significant loss of, I'm hungry if I eat only 1,200 calories a day, significant bone loss from their hip and upper thigh region, regardless of whether they did resistance training. So if you eat too few calories and you exercise too much, you're going to lose bone density, especially if you do too much cardio. Why if you do too much cardio? If you're doing too much cardio, in order to perform your cardio, you need cortisol. Your adrenals are going to make cortisol for you because they're going to run your heart, your lungs, your muscles, they're going to run your sympathetic nervous system. And so if you sit in a cortisol bath, whether it's from too much cardio exercise or it's from too much stress, and you don't counterbalance that with rest and good diet resistance training, you're going to be more likely to lose bone density. And there are people who get scared that they're going to gain weight, so they drop their calories too much and then they do a lot of cardio. That is a recipe for fractures. You're going to lose your bone density. You need to find that sweet spot of eating enough healthy food that is going to sustain you and your exercise and reduce your rest and find other ways to reduce your cortisol. But you have to eat to sustain yourself. It's not a good idea to eat so little that you're hungry and you're not going to perform as well. That's the thing. It's worth it to eat more calories when you're doing a sport because you're going to perform better, whether it's cardio or whether it's muscle resistance training. It doesn't matter what it is. You're going to perform better if you eat to your sport. And if you're concerned about eating too many calories, it's not. If you look at what Weight Watchers is doing, or WW right now, what they talk about, there's so many foods that are 0 points. And the foods that are 0 points are generally protein and produce. The protein and produce, you don't even worry about calories or points for that. If you're eating fruits and vegetables and clean protein, in WW they don't even have points. So you probably don't need to worry about calories for those foods. I mean, it's true. If you eat an extreme excess of calories, you're going to gain weight. But you're much less likely to gain weight from eating extra protein. Protein is not a great way for your body. It's very costly to your body to try to break down protein for energy. Your body can do it. There is something called gluconeogenesis when you are breaking down muscle mass to make sugar when you don't have enough carbohydrate around. So your body can do that. And when you have too much cortisol around, that is exactly what happens. Cortisol's job is to go around your body looking for protein to break down and turn into sugar so you can run away from the bear or do your work day or do your very long workout or whatever it is. And so to counterbalance that, you need to eat adequate protein. And if you have more muscle mass, whatever your sport is, you're going to do better at it. Big shout out to Paige Beckers, who was getting too many fractures, right? So she improved her protein consumption and went to the weight room. So she increased her protein. She increased her resistance training and she gained some weight, which is terrific. And probably most of the weight that she gained was muscle mass. So she's going to perform better. She's going to feel happier. And some of the protein that she's eating went to her bones. So she's going to be less likely to have fractures. So big shout out to Paige. We hope your health is really good. She's playing amazingly. You know, you're listening to me in Israel and you're like, who's Paige Beckers? So I'm sorry about that. So Paige Beckers is a star University of Connecticut women's basketball player. So big shout out to her and all the women's basketball players, Aaliyah and Q. And Aaliyah I met in Price Chopper once, and that was really fun. She's like, here, let's take a picture. And she grabbed my phone and we did selfies and it was great. So I have a nice picture of the gorgeous, tall, she has purple and yellow braids because in honor of Kobe Bryant. My sister saw her and said, oh, is she a Lakers fan? I said, yeah, she's a Lakers fan. But more than that, she's a Kobe his daughter that passed in the plane accident. So anyway, eat your protein and don't be afraid of the calories in the protein. Don't be afraid of the calories in fruit and vegetables. If you want to concern yourself with calories, the place to be concerned about them is carbohydrate, and especially refined carbohydrate, and eating a little bit of, so I was going to say, you know, eating a little bit of high quality carbohydrate isn't going to hurt you, but I shouldn't say that because there are people on ketogenic diets who do them and they feel fabulous when they do them and it really works for them. There are even people on carnivore diets who do fantastically on those. I think those people are unusual. And if that's you, then that's terrific. I mean, obviously the best diet for you is the insert your name here diet. The best diet for Fran is the Fran diet. The best diet for Karen is the Karen diet. The best diet for Brian is the Brian diet. Best diet for anyone is the diet that works for them. But I'm going to tell you, if you want to maintain your bone density and your muscle mass, you need to eat protein. And you probably need to eat somewhere between 70 and 100 grams a day. So do that. Okay. All right. You might want to consider taking a collagen supplement. I'm doing that. And there's not great research on it, but collagen is the main protein that's in your bones. That's why everybody's doing bone broth, so they can get collagen. The thing with collagen is that when we're eating muscle tissue of animals, so we don't eat the things in animals that have collagen. We don't eat organs so much. Most people are less likely to eat liver and kidneys and other organ meats, the places where there's a lot of collagen, and we don't eat the gizzards and the places that have a lot of cartilage and tendons, and the bones are going to have a lot of collagen. So, for years and years, people weren't eating a lot of protein, and when they did, they were eating just muscle tissue. And so I prefer to eat the muscle tissue, but I have no problem consuming a soup that has bone broth in it, and my chosen protein shake is bone broth protein. And so I'm getting bone broth protein every single day. And I'm also taking separate collagen as a supplement. So I should have pretty good bone density right now. It'll give you nice skin, nice hair, nice fingernails, and it's going to give you nice bones. And that has been studied. So collagen has glycine, proline, and lysine, which are important amino acids to build your bone mass. Collagen hydrolysate is from animal bones, and that's gelatin. And it's been used to relieve joint pain for many years. I'm not taking gelatin. I'm taking a collagen supplement that has Chinese skullcap in it, which is a great anti-inflammatory, also helps to go after Lyme disease, which is brilliant. And so I take that every day. And I really think that that was a big thing that got me through, a bad case of back pain and knee pain. I have arthritis, but joint degeneration, particularly in my right knee, and my right knee is so much better doing that daily collagen. And if you give there's a study on postmenopausal women with osteoporosis, gave them collagen and calcitonin, and they had less collagen breakdown. So they're probably doing urinary NTX and telepeptide testing, and found that they had a lower telepeptide loss. So you should maintain a stable, healthy weight. So being at a healthy weight can support your bone health. If you weigh too little, it increases your risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis, especially if you're postmenopausal. So losing too much weight when you're postmenopausal is not a good idea. You want to have a little meat to you. If you're too skinny, you're not going to have enough muscle mass, and you're probably not eating enough, and you're probably not eating enough protein, and then you're going to get bone density issues. On the other hand, if you're obese, that can impair your bone quality too. There's one thought that it's the risk of fractures due to excess weight. I don't know that it's just that. It's also that if you're obese, you have more inflammatory compounds in the excess fat. And those inflammatory compounds, when you have inflammation, you have increased cortisol and you get more bony breakdown. When you have more inflammation, you have more breakdown of tissue because of the interaction of those inflammatory compounds as well as cortisol. So weight loss can result in some bone loss. It's less pronounced in obese with individuals than if you're normal weight. So if you start out obese, and you're going to lose less bone density if you try to lose weight. Repeatedly losing and gaining weight is bad for bone health, and as well as losing a lot of weight all at once. So try to lose weight, you want to do it slowly, and so I'm wondering with the use of all these weight loss drugs, the GLP-1 enhancers like your semaglutides, right, and your tirzepatides, I'm wondering how that's affecting people's bone density, because they're just taking a drug that's modifying their metabolism, and they're not necessarily, you know, getting, I'm sure they're getting some exercise, but I bet not everybody is. It's because it's manipulating the metabolism. I wonder if there's a relationship between taking those drugs and losing bone density. It's an interesting question. And there's a study that showed that bone loss during weight loss was not reversed when weight was regained. So repeated cycles of losing and gaining weight can affect your bone density. So you want to maintain a stable weight. Pick a weight that you like and stay there. And even if it's a little bit heavier than maybe you'd like to be, you're better off staying there than doing yo-yo dieting. You want to eat magnesium and zinc. Magnesium and zinc are also important for bone density. So magnesium is part of trabecular bone. It's part of the bone that goes through the cross-section of the bone. And magnesium is important for converting vitamin D, making vitamin D active. So having magnesium on board is really important. And those women who ate at least 400 milligrams of magnesium a day have a 2-3%, that's modest, higher bone density than women who have half of that amount. Magnesium is found in small amounts in foods. There are only a few great sources. And supplement, this is where you want to supplement. And my favorite magnesium, I like magnesium glycinate because it's very easy to absorb. I think it's my favorite supplement because of cost and also ease of absorption. And the glycine is calming, and the glycine also is a component of collagen. There's magnesium L-threonate, which gets into your brain the most readily, although magnesium glycinate does as well. Magnesium L-threonate tends to be more expensive, but it is great if you're trying to take it for anxiety. Magnesium carbonate and citrate are not as absorbable, and so they are absorbable to an extent, because my patients who take magnesium citrate as a drink, they definitely feel calmer. And how much of it is that it's getting in peripherally and calming their muscles and nerves, that's why they feel calmer, or is some of it getting into the brain? It's probably a little bit of both. And it does, so it must get in that at some rate. Magnesium carbonate, I'm not excited about. Magnesium oxide, I would only take, you could take that as a laxative because it kind of goes right through you. Zinc is a trace mineral that's needed in small amounts. It helps to make up the mineral portion of your bones. Zinc is also great for your immune system, and it's also great for wound healing. It's great for the integrity of your skin. And it promotes the formation of bone-building cells and prevents excessive bone breakdown. And that supports bone growth in children and the maintenance of bone density in older adults. Beef, shrimp, spinach, flax seeds, oysters, and pumpkin seeds have a decent amount of zinc in them. Then there's omega-3 fatty acids. They're anti-inflammatory. They help to protect against bone loss, probably because they reduce inflammation, so you don't have the inflammatory piece of bone loss. And you want to make sure that your omega-3 to omega-6 ratio is in the right place. You only want to have a 4-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3, not higher. And those who have a higher ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 have lower bone density because too much omega-6 can be inflammatory. So, like I said, 4-to-1 or lower. So most studies have looked at long chain omega-3 fats in fatty fish. Omega-3 plant sources help decrease bone breakdown too. So that's going to be your nuts and seeds, your flax seeds and your pumpkin seeds and your sunflower seeds. So bone density is important for all of the stages of your life. And so there's nutritional pieces to it. There's exercise pieces to it. You need to make sure you're getting enough vitamin D. You need to make sure you're getting resistance training and that you're getting adequate rest and that you're eating enough protein. And you're eating protein and vegetables are huge when it comes to bone density. And then you want to get your doctor to test you for your vitamin D level. So you make sure that it's where it's supposed to be. And if it's not adequate, then you want to take an amount of vitamin D that gets you between 35 and 45 nanograms per milliliter. So, wow, we talked mostly about bone density today, which is great. And there's a lot of other cool age-related topics that I want to talk about. So depending when you're listening to this, it may be before Christmas, it may be after Christmas, or perhaps you're going to celebrate the solstice. And we're all done with Hanukkah now. So I hope anybody who's celebrating Hanukkah, I hope you had a happy Hanukkah. And this is a time of year when it's nice to hunker down. It's nice to get more rest. It's nice to put those restorative practices in because, I don't know, for me, in terms of cardio, I don't feel as energetic this time of year. And it's okay to lean into that and take more naps and get more rest and do more restorative type activity. That's where my moderate yoga and my gentle yin yoga, gentle stretches and restorative yoga comes in. It's a really great time of year to implement those things. They'll make you feel so much better. I tend to do the restorative practices closer to the end of the day because it helps me to ease into calming down at night. And I tend not to try to accomplish too much in the evening. If I want to accomplish stuff, I do it during the day. Right now I'm recording this sort of towards the middle of the day, and that's a good time for me to get stuff done. All right, so I'm going to let you go. And we're going to talk more about age-related topics in the next couple of weeks. But I'm going to sign off now. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores and WHUS.org.